Chapter 31. Larry Turner's house looked neglected, uncared for. Weeds were fast overtaking the plants in the front garden, and the small lawn was long overdue for a cut. Marie had a bad feeling about it.
"I get the feeling we're going to draw a blank, don't you, Sarge?"
Max said.
"Doesn't look the kind of place where someone would keep a valuable gun collection, does it?"
Marie agreed. It was a small, old-style, semi-detached house just off the main road into Hartley O'Dyke. With a little more care, it could have been as attractive as the adjoining house, which certainly put Larry Turner's to shame. Max rang the doorbell and waited. After a while, he bent down and looked through the letterbox, then turned to Marie.
"There's been some kind of disturbance. Stuff all over the floor and a broken table lamp. I'll go round the back."
Marie ran around the side of the house, through a low gate and into the back garden. She tried the back door and the French windows, but all were locked. She peered in, but could see no further signs of anything being amiss. She glanced up to the bedroom windows and saw that one was slightly ajar. No way could she get inside that way. Then she noticed a shadowy figure behind the curtains of the house next door.
"It's okay. We're the police," she called out,
and held up her warrant card.
"Could you come out and talk to us, please?"
A few moments later, an elderly lady stood on the other side of the fence.
"Can I see that warrant card properly? And what do you want?"
The accent was a local one, and she was obviously not a trusting sort of person. In fact, she looked downright hostile.
"I'm Detective Sergeant Marie Evans. My colleague DC Max Cohen and I are trying to find Mr. Turner."
"Haven't seen him in weeks. And not a word to me to say he was going anywhere."
The old lady looked put out.
"I know he's been poorly, but there are such things as good manners, and he promised to feed my Henry this week so I could have a few days with my sister in Skeggy. Had to cancel, and she ain't best pleased."
"Oh dear, I'm sorry to hear that. I suppose you don't hold a key for him, do you?"
Marie asked.
"Oh no, we gets along fine, but he's a private man, and he wouldn't go handing keys out. Says he's got things in the house that's under lock and key, and it's best they stays that way. Things to do with his work with you lot, I suppose."
"Probably," said Marie vaguely.
"You didn't hear anything like the sound of a fight before he went, did you?" The woman shook her head.
"No, but I does have my TV up loud, on account of my hearing aid playing up. Anyway, he was a quiet man. I've never heard no raised voices, even when he had his friend around."
"His friend?"
"Tall, well-spoken man used to call recently. Very polite, he were. Said he went target shooting with Larry."
Marie pulled a copy of the latest picture of Alistair Ashcroft from her pocket and handed it over the fence.
"Is this the man?"
The old lady squinted at it.
"That's him. Only his hair was different. Same eyes, though. Yes, that's the fella."
She passed the photo back. As Marie took it from her, she saw Max walking round the side passageway.
"This lady here says that Ashcroft was visiting Larry, but he's been away for weeks."
"With his sister in Weymouth?"
asked Max.
"Weymouth?"
The neighbour stared at him.
"He never mentioned no Weymouth. I thought his sister was abroad, teaching English in some Belgium college."
"Really?"
Max looked at Marie.
"Time to effect an entry, as they say. What do you think?"
"Agreed.
Thanks, Mrs... you've been a great help."
They went back round to the front.
"I've already checked the windows, and this is too tough to shoulder in," Max said, pushing at the door.
"I'll ring and get an enforcer brought over," Marie said. While they waited, to Marie's surprise, the next door neighbour appeared carrying two mugs of tea.
"I watch them cop dramas on the telly, so I know you'll be wanting this. If you want sugar, I'll go and get it. My name's Betty, by the way."
"This is great. Thanks, Betty."
Marie smiled at her.
"Tell me, what sort of man is Larry, other than private?"
"Hard to say."
Betty's brow creased in concentration.
"He's not your typical yellow belly,"
she said, using the local term for people born and bred in Lincolnshire.
"Really does keep himself to himself. Never once seen a lady friend visit. And he doesn't go down to the local for a pint with the lads. Tell you the truth, I'd be a bit worried about him if he was my boy."
"And how often did the man in the photo visit, Betty?"
Marie asked.
"Quite a bit over the last month," I was pleased to see Larry had a friend at last, but then he got ill. I think it's what you call a nervous breakdown. Anyway, after that, the friend came less often, she shrugged. And that's it, really.
It was 10 minutes before the vehicle with the enforcer arrived. They stared at the as-yet-unopened door.
I hate this bit, Max said.
Marie knew what he meant. It was a feeling she should have got used to after so many years in the job, but probably no one did. Excitement of what you might find, yet also fear of the same thing. With a crack of rending wood, the enforcer broke through. Max went in first, with Marie at his heels. They moved from room to room, but nothing seemed out of place other than the things lying on the hall floor.
Bit odd, wouldn't you say, Sarge?
Max looked puzzled.
I'd be expecting to see more upheaval.
Marie looked around, trying to get a feel for what Larry Turner was like. The house gave little away. There were a few photos, all related to work, mostly of Turner and his mates in uniform, toting their rifles. There were some medals in a case, and a few highly polished trophies, and a pretty impressive sound system and record deck. But other than that and some shooting magazines, the place was almost bare. And it was an exclusively male domain, with nothing about it indicating a woman's touch. No attempt to make the place a home. They avoided disturbing the things in the hall just in case this turned out to be a crime scene, and started up the stairs. Marie was almost certain that they were going to find the mortal remains of authorized firearms officer PC Larry Turner. Yet that kind of discovery was usually preceded by the unforgettable stench of decaying flesh. This house smelt a little musty, as any would if it had been locked up for some time. But other than that, she smelt nothing. So why this sense of foreboding? She kept thinking about the way the real Ezra Lorimer had been callously terminated when his usefulness ended. Surely it would have been the same with this man. With every step, her trepidation mounted. Max had slowed down too. Glancing at him, Marie guessed he felt as she did. They reached a short landing with three doors leading off it, each one firmly shut. Max took a determined breath and opened the first. Marie looked into a small family bathroom. It was clean, functional, and tiled to the ceiling in silvery faux marble high-gloss tiles. There was a white bath and a shower cubicle, basin and toilet. On the windowsill was a china toothbrush holder with a single brush and the usual toothpaste. Towels still hung over the heated towel rail, all pristine. She'd been in hotel bathrooms less immaculate. Max pulled the door closed and, with a glance at her, opened the second door. What was intended as the guest bedroom was being used as Larry's study and gun room. Along one wall was a desk with a laptop and a letter rack, and rather incongruously, a retro-design Mathmos lava lamp.
Rocket Telstar, Max crooned. My favourite.
Marie shook her head. Well, I learn something new about you every day, Max Korn. She turned her attention to the rest of the room. Basically gun cabinets and a workbench with cans of oil, soft cloths and a variety of other tins and bottles. The bad thing about it was that the cabinet doors were all wide open, and there were some very conspicuous gaps in the rows of guns.
Blood.
Max pointed to a stain on the carpet, close to one of the cabinets.
I thought it was spilt oil, but it's blood all right.
It looked as though she had been right to be concerned.
We'll finish our sweep and then ring this in. We'll need forensics, and we'll need to check how many guns are licensed under his name to know how many and which are missing.
She ran her eyes over the room again, but saw nothing else by way of evidence.
Okay, last room coming up, said Max, and swallowed.
Marie stepped forward and pushed the door open. For a moment, nothing she saw computed. Then she smelt it.
Oh, dear Lord, what has he done this time?
Max slipped in past her and stopped in his tracks.
Fucking hell.
Ring Jackman now, Max. Tell him we have another victim and we need Rory here pronto. She closed her eyes, but the scene remained, seared into the back of her eyelids.
It had to be Larry Turner, but only forensics would tell her that.
The body lay on the bed in a recumbent position, reminding her of pictures she'd seen of mummified Egyptian pharaohs, except the bandages had been replaced by heavy-duty cling film, the wide stuff that they used for packing furniture for transport. From what she could make out, the victim had been stripped and then wrapped into a tight cocoon. From the amount of blood within the package, she guessed that this person had met the same end as Ezra Lorimer. He looked like a giant side of meat ready for the freezer. Because of the wrapping, very little smell had leaked out into the atmosphere, but Marie could see that in places fluids were starting to seep onto the bed linen. If he'd been left much longer, the smell would have been unbearable. Marie thanked God she hadn't made forensics her career. Imagine having to deal with this abomination. As soon as the words were out, she hated herself for them. This abomination was another living, feeling human being who'd fallen foul of Alistair Ashcroft's twisted mind. Another police officer. Max touched her shoulder. Jackman's on his way, Sarge. He's asked for a priority on forensics. He stared at the bed and its occupant. If only I was religious, I feel I should be saying a prayer for that poor guy. Marie turned to go.
We've seen enough.
Alistair Ashcroft hurried away from the church. The voices and the clamour were becoming hard to bear, and he'd been planning to spend a little time in the quiet of the old building. But as he had turned into the road, he'd seen more people milling about by the foyer than usual, and warning bells had rung. There were no uniforms in sight, but he had a strong feeling that Jackman had put two and two together regarding the church. He gritted his teeth. Now where to go? There was no time to drive out to one of his wild places on the marsh. He had too much to do. He got into his car and drove to a small car park that looked out over the river. It was never busy, being too far away from the shops in the town centre, and today it was almost empty. It would have to do. He paid for an hour, locked the car, and found a narrow footpath that ran down to some old disused moorings. Occasionally a lone fisherman would try his luck there, but today there was no one in sight. Ashcroft sank down onto a low seat that the fisherman used and stared at the greenish, murky water of the river. This was what he needed, quiet and solitude, some peace in which to unravel the twisted, tangled mess of his thoughts. Some of these involved Paul Lorimer. The urge to kill that stupid boy was almost more than he could bear, but he needed him for his plan. And he needed to fulfill that plan, to gaze upon the lifeless bodies of Rowan Jackman and his Marie, before he could leave this dead and alive hole forever. By the time he stood up again some 30 minutes later, the last detail of his plan was in place, and he felt almost serene. He ought to know by now that these temporary malfunctions in his thought processes were to be expected. After all, the stupidity of those with whom he came in contact was sometimes more than he could bear. Even Jackman had turned out to be a disappointment. At least his frustration was slightly appeased by the thought of the strain he had subjected the entire Salton police force to. Most satisfying of all had been his relentless harassment of that young PC. He had chosen Kevin Stoner, having noted his compassion towards the street people of Salton, plus the fact that he was homosexual and therefore more vulnerable. Ashcroft had no real sense of what he subjected others to, being entirely without empathy himself. Like a feral child, he'd had no family to model himself on. "I'm the invisible man," Ashcroft said to himself, "and so I'm invulnerable." He laughed. Poor Jackman, and poor Marie. Soon they would be paying the price for proving such unworthy opponents. By midnight, Alistair Ashcroft would be on his way to a new life, a new campaign. He started his car. Now for Paul Lorimer. Ashcroft turned off the engine again. It had come to him to wonder what made him so particularly angry towards that stupid boy. He thought of Paul tied to that chair, powerless and trembling in fear. Fear of the unknown, dread of the coming pain and humiliation. Himself, as a child, how he'd hated that weak and feeble boy. Well, He was that child no longer. He had molded himself into a new man, someone unique. And he would show his uniqueness by sparing the life of Paul Lorimer, who was least worthy of being spared.